You know, I was sitting there thinking,
I thought it was going to be on a tie of gold.
Did he tell you he was going to do that?
Yeah. No.
I always thought, let's get in the conference committee with both going way up. And then,
but the true sign.
Compromising.
Yeah.
I should lose the guy.
Committee on Transportation will come to order. Folks, we got a very long agenda, and I'm sure that nobody wants to really stay here much past night tonight. So if we could keep our...
That's good.
He wants to be here past midnight. Let's put it that way. So if we keep our remarks, directed right at the bill, make them as succinct as possible, we would greatly appreciate that. We're going to hop around on the agenda a little bit so that we can get some of the people who have... Just a minute. Thank you. So that we can get these bills out of here, but we're going to hop around a little bit so that visitors from out of town can get home to their families. First up, we're going to take Senate File 156. It's Senator Limmer's bill on the designation of the Purple Heart Trail. Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You may be able to see we have some distinguished visitors to the Senate today. We have representatives of the Purple Heart Military Order of the Purple Heart. And upon their request, Senate File 156 is before you. They have a nationwide program coming from their national organization to represent a major freeway or highway in every state and designate it as a Purple Heart Trail. In Minnesota, they've recognized after considerable research Highway 94 to be a possible road for that designation. I have Mr. Murphy, Patrick Murphy from Maple Grove, and Richard Jenkins from Newport, Minnesota, here representing the order, and they're anxious to talk to you about their bill. You may notice, Senator Murphy, that Patrick Murphy, I don't know if you're a relative or not, but
Uncle Pat and
guys,
I go way
so,
back.
Maybe you go way back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll bet if he could fight.
Yeah. Why don't we introduce Mr. Murphy first?
Mr. Murphy, state your name for the record, please. It's ready to go.
It's ready to go.
Well, I got a letter here that I started 4 years ago, and I'm just to read part of it. I received this Purple Heart kit from Mr. George Gallagher, and he designated me as the president of the Purple Heart Trail. And he told me to name an assistant. I did, and Jeff Olson, Veteran Commissioner of Affairs. Our goal was to consider Highway 1, Interstate 94, to be the Purple Heart Trail from the Wisconsin border west to the North Dakota border. We hoped that this would be established in 2002, but it was turned down the first time in 2001 because it was no money involved. We figured the money might be involved in this program. Fairnot put it on the floor, but he did not invite me, or no, I had no knowledge of being here. Again, he put it the second time on the floor, but the senator wanted to have the governor or someone from his staff to come forward because they wanted more information on the Purple Heart Trail. This, I don't know if it was ever done. I never heard anything about it. So I let it go that year. The following year, they brought the Purple Heart Memorial Drive by Fast National Commander Rooley in his hometown of Brainerd, which was passed. I didn't want to interfere in his project because it does have a different project than the Purple Heart. This here is a project of the Military Order of the Purple Heart. This was established in 1997. It was passed signed by the Congress, and the chapter department in West Virginia started. They have a lot of state in the East Coast that's already coming this way. Wisconsin got it 4 years ago, 2 years ago. Iowa has it. Montana has it. Washington has it. And California. The longest state trail is going to be 80. That's from Pennsylvania straight through to California. Now, if Wisconsin comes in with coming down, they don't have 94, but they're thinking about it. They're working on it now. They want to come down from 19 and hit 94. If that happened, we passed this in Minnesota, and we would come in with North Dakota has one chapter. If I go up there and help them to pass that up there, then we would be the second longest trail in the nation. We believe we have more to offer on Interstate 94 than any other highway. I took it upon myself to drive down the Wisconsin border, turn around, came back to see how many truck stops I could find. First was St. Paul. We had much to offer in St. Paul and Minneapolis. You had the state capitol, you had businesses. Minneapolis, you had the Target Center, Metrodome, a new ballpark maybe. It was a long drive before I came all the way from St. Paul up to the first truck stop I stopped at was Rogers. They have fuel, food, and lodging. The next truck stop I came to was Clearwater. They have the same. Clearwater, then I went to Sauk Center. At Sauk Center, they have the same. Then I went to Alexander, Fergus Falls, and Moorhead. I stayed overnight, then I came back the one way, the other way, the next day. And I found there's be 14 or 16 signs. The Purple Heart Trail would be mounted like this on Interstate 94. We, the veterans of the armed forces, have been wounded by the veterans of all war. Men and women would be proud to have Interstate 94 named in our honor. It would be a tribute to the thousands of men and women who have served and earned the Purple Heart. Freedom is not cheap. We ask you to pass this bill in our honor. I will pay all costs for this project up front, because I have to present this bill to the department convention, which is June 1st and the 2nd. This cannot be done because this has to go through the transportation office. When they give me the bill, it may be later, it may be the summer. So then I have to wait to the fall conference or the spring conference. They will reimburse me. Now, if the transportation allow me, there's two signs I'd like to add to it. And that would be one in St. Paul naming the seven that's up there. Maybe you have this in front of you, showing where all the truck stops are. But I don't know if they allow that, because it might be a hazard, I don't know. Well, this is something that I have to work out with the transportation office. Now, I worked for Nagley for better than 25 years. I was a pictorial artist. I paint pictures on billboards. So I painted a lot of silk screen, metal sign, paper sign, and I know how to treat metal. And I'm sure they'll do the same. You know, spray the one coat primer. The main coat will be purple. They'll bake it. Then they'll have a stencil made. And then they'll silk screen the Purple Heart Trail on that. That sign will last longer. Now, if the transportation will allow us, if this bill is passed, allow us to go and mount these on these interstate signs, we will do so. That's up to transportation if they allow us to do that. They may not. Could be hazard on the highway.
Yeah, Mr. Murphy, they probably won't let you put them up, but they will. And you have to understand that they have to have, signs have to meet a certain specification, and you'll probably have to have them made by a certified dealer.
Yeah, I understand that.
Right, and but it's my, and just for the members here, we've done this before, and there's about 40 different designations across the state. And if you look at line 10 of the bill, basically what that chapter of law says is that, you know, the folks like the Order of Purple Heart here are going to pay for the signs, and then the state's going to put them up.
Yeah.
And it's your intention to put these up outside of the rest areas on the way up towards North Dakota?
There's a sign, Mr. Chairman, there's an Interstate 94 sign just before each one of these shopping centers there. Truck stop. And that's why I figure that's the best place, because it brings business to those cities.
Okay.
Chairman Murphy, my name is Richard Jenkins, Senior Vice Commander of the Military Order of Purple Heart. Senator Murphy, Chairman Murphy, and fellow constituents, I would just like to piggyback on what Commander Murphy had just shared with you. This is a way to honor our veterans. We have recipients of the Military Order of Purple Heart who are both male and female. Unlike the Vietnam War that I served in 42 years ago, we have men and women who have been wounded, and they're being treated at the VA hospital in the Brain Traumatic Center, where I volunteer every Wednesday. The main thing is to let you know that we are here to answer your questions, and to, if you have any concerns whatsoever, we'll be more than happy to address that. Mm-hmm. I will be taking over as the commander of the Military Order of Purple Heart for the state of Minnesota in June. And we all work closely together in order to ensure that this trail goes forth. We will be attending the National Military Order of Purple Heart Convention in New York, and we would like to at least address them to let them know that we have this bill before you. And if you'd be so kind to implement it, it will be an added incentive for all returning veterans. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jenkins. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langseth.
Well, no, this is a very long trail. It goes all the way from across the state. And I was just wondering, suppose, let's say, between Sauk Center and Alexandria, there was some person they wanted to honor. Could they do that in that section, even though this was designated? Mm-hmm. You could kind of double up on that.
That's correct, Senator Langseth. As a matter of fact, I do believe that there's a couple sections of this highway. The whole thing is either the Blue Star Memorial or the Eisenhower Memorial. So this would just kind of coincide with those designations. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not a question, really, but just a comment. I'm not a big fan of naming highways or anything, but this one, I think, merits our consideration. I like the idea. It runs right through the heart of Minnesota. I think we need to honor the folks that have gone and served our country, and I'm fully in support of it. Mm-hmm. Now, I've learned a little bit from Senator Limmer on wanting to put some amendments out on things, but I'll pass on something like that tonight, but I just want to say I do support this idea.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the bill if we're ready for that motion.
Okay. I just wanted to make a real quick comment. These are two veterans here, and there's other veterans, obviously, part of the order. And we greatly appreciate the sacrifices that you and your families have made. So thank you. On that,
Mr. Sherburne, may I have the opportunity to introduce my adjutant from my chapter and his wife, who is a national officer, Mrs. Kovar.
Thanks for coming today. We
had many
it.
More were supposed to come, but we changed the hour from 12:30 to 6:30, so many had other appointments to make.
Yeah. There's a lot of us. I'm looking around the room. We all had other appointments, but we're here. So
we can't make them all, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Murphy. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to echo your comments. Thank the witnesses for their service to our country and bringing this bill forward. It looks like you've been working on it for a while. It looks like the states near us have kind of put us to shame. So I think it's time for us to pass this bill and catch up with Iowa and Wisconsin on this. So.
Yep.
Proud to be a co-author on this bill.
Senator Fischbach has moved that Senate File 156 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. We'll put this on the consent calendar if there's no objections with the committee. And Mr. Murphy, Mr. Jenkins, that just pretty much means it's a slam dunk if it goes to the consent calendar, okay? All right. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, on behalf of the Purple Heart, the military of Purple Heart, and my assistants, we want to thank you and the Senator for allowing us to come on the floor to speak to you today and for passing this bill. God bless you. Thank you.
To you too, yeah. Uncle Pat.
Uncle Pat. I'm going to go back a few years.
And Mr. Chair, most of the time you're not a bad guy to be related to, so yeah.
Most of the time.
Not that I'm related to you, but I was just warning.
Okay, Senator Sinjum, you're next up. You're closest to the table. Senator Sinjum, this bill is on the Mississippi River Parkway Commission, and this is an expiration date extension. This does need to go to state and local when it's done here. So,
right.
Senator Sinjum.
Correct.
Senate File 289.
Thank you, Senator Murphy and members. My name is Senator Murphy. Seems to play pretty well. I can make this fairly short. This is a bill to extend the life of the Mississippi River Parkway Commission. It's an organization I've been a part of since I joined the Senate. Senator Saxhog has been a member along the way, and Senator Torres Ray is new this year. And we have a couple of House members and, of course, public members, and also members that are involved representing specific agencies of state government. The whole theme of the commission is to promote tourism and certainly highway funding to the what we call the Great River Road. It is the road into the joints of Mississippi River as it travels through Minnesota. And, by the way, this organization is also part of a 10-state network going down to Louisiana. It's an organization that I think is creditable, has done good work, and I hope that we can extend it. And I'll just stop there and prevent there any questions.
Thank you. Senator Koch moves that Senate File 289 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Chair.
Thank you, Senator Sinjum. Senator Dahl, let's where'd he run off to?
Senator Paris was here.
We were trying to take him in the order of ease here. Okay, we're going to take Senate File 913, Senator Betzel. And
Mr. Chair, and thank you. I have a family matter that needs immediate attention. Senate File 913 would allow some sharing of driver's license data with other agencies. Right now it's protected data. This would allow the prosecutors and the public defenders to have access to it. I believe Senator Bonoff, or somebody, there might be an amendment to this, which I'm aware of, that would also extend to the courts, and that is for the purpose of having the data also shared for no contact or order for protection. Mm-hmm. This issue had been reviewed about a week ago in the, there's a CredNet bill that's going around within the Judiciary Committee, and so I believe that bill may be coming to you as well, too. So you might see this issue coming up in another matter. I believe I may have a witness or two around here. If they're here, please show up now. But otherwise, I'll stand for any questions. I left my folder upstairs. I'm just going to check in right now with Mr. Chair. So.
Yeah, we understand, Senator Betzold. Senator Bonhoff has moved the A2 amendment. Senator Bonhoff, this just basically does not allow this information to be shared when someone has a no-contact order.
Mr. Chair, what this amendment does is Senator Betzold is expanding the use of driver's license photos to several different areas, and this amendment allows the driver's license photo to be used in enforcing no-contact orders so that, in fact, a photo of the offender could be put on a no-contact order, that the courts would have access to the photos with this amendment.
All right. On the Bonhoff A2 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Is there anyone that wants to speak either for or against this bill? I'll take that as a no. We're cooking right along. Senator Gimsey moves that Senate File 913 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor.
Our judiciary, I think we need to see this.
We're working on some issues in judiciary.
That's fine.
On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Betzold. All right, Senator Dahl, you're up.
Chair, members, this is Senate File 1201. What this basically does is it change the maximum truck length allowed for single vehicles from 40 to 45 feet in overall length. It's a doesn't change the weight limits on any of these trucks, and it's been billed. This bill's been reviewed by MnDOT, State Patrol, Truckers Association, and AAA, and we have no opposition to it at this point.
All right. Just one question, Senator Dahl. I see that there's stricken language. Oh, no, never mind. I get it.
Brings everything kind of in uniformity with the lengths.
Right.
And it's mainly to bring because of federal regulations on air emission standards. So they give them a little extra room to put those that equipment in.
Put those like power packs and stuff like that on it. Right. Okay. Yeah, this is a federal conformity issue. Mm-hmm. So we do actually need to do this. Senator Dahl has moved that Senate File 1201 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Is there anybody here that wants to speak either for or against the bill? Seeing none on Senator Dahl's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Senator Skoy, 1069. Senator Skoy.
Mr. Chair, I have the A2 amendment that I'd like to have passed out.
All right, Senator Skoy.
But before we adopt the amendment, I would like to say a few words, if I could, please. I'd like to talk about the bill before I adopt the amendment.
Go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair and members, you'll see this as a weekly inventory reports bill. And this is a result of some contacts I've had with gas station and convenience store owners about getting transparency in the price of gasoline in the state of Minnesota. As we have worked on this issue this session, Mr. Krogman and Mr. Schoenfeld have joined me. They have had numerous contacts with the refiners and terminal operators in the state that there would be problems with regard to this reporting that I was asking for. They have done a fair amount of work, and we do have the A2 amendment that I would like to offer at this time, and then I would like them to talk about the A2 amendment, if I could, Mr. Chair.
All right. Well, let's talk with Mr. Krogman start off.
Mr. Chair, it'll be to the A2 amendment then.
Right. You're going to be speaking to the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bob Krogman. I'm with the Minnesota Petroleum Marketers Association. What the A2 amendment does is require the terminals, refinery terminals, to report to the Director of Weights and Measures when certain products are not physically available. And that means that if someone pulling into that terminal, punching in the right numbers, could not load the product in their transport truck for delivery to service stations, convenience stores, truck stops, or customers. This comes from last summer, for example. There was more than once when, for example, ethanol was out of the terminal. You'd pull in, there would be no ethanol there, and the state requires 10% ethanol, and the truck operator doesn't have an option. He either pulls no fuel, goes terminal hopping if he's even got terminal access agreement signed, or pulls the gas and brings it to his station. If there is gas without that, it would be without ethanol, could be a misdemeanor. The second portion of the bill says the Director of Weights and Measures may waive a penalty for a violation of the mandates, pulling gasoline or diesel fuel without those, if in fact the fuels were unavailable at the terminal system. The terminal has to regularly handle the product. That's where it says 20 of the previous 30 days. This would keep someone from trying to play games and picking a terminal that never handles biodiesel or ethanol. This simply says if there's some glitch in the infrastructure where you cannot get those products, that you would not be subject to penalties. I'd answer any questions.
Mr. Krogman, quickly, this would also allow them to suspend the blend in case we had a problem like last winter where some of the diesel that was blended with biodiesel, we had a little problem with some fuel filter clogs and...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, on the first page of it, excuse me, that would allow the commissioner to grant an exemption from the rules if, in fact, the biodiesel is out of specification, unavailable, or some problems. Mm-hmm. And that was a couple years ago. Last year we had relatively few problems with biodiesel.
I'm sorry, Mr. Krogman, the years are blending together. Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Soybean Growers Association, and as you and others may remember, was kind of the one of the people that worked a lot on the biodiesel mandate. And so I am just here to tell you that we worked with Mr. Krogman on this language and are okay with it, so that there's we feel that the 20 of 30 days provision in particular helps to ensure that these are truly glitches in the system where for one reason or another there's not availability at that date. So mm-hmm. We would support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Schoenfeld. Senator Scoy has moved the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Is there, this just sounds like a common sense way of taking care of maybe a couple glitches in the system. And, Mr. Krogman, this doesn't happen. This is not a weekly occurrence or a monthly occurrence. It's just something that happens periodically.
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. It is an occasional occurrence.
Okay. Is there anybody here that wants to testify either in support or against this bill? Seeing none, Senator Scoy moves that Senate file 1096 as amended be recommended to pass. And I'm sorry, 1069. be recommended to pass, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Commerce. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Members, the chair made a mistake there. That bill is supposed to go to the Senate floor. We will revote. Senator Skoy moves that Senate File 1069, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Sorry about that. Senator Parisot, are you... Senator Parisot. Senator Parisot, Senate File 605.
Mr. Chairman and members, collecting materials off your stand over here. It's a very short bill before you, as you can see. We do have several witnesses, however. Our county attorney from Dakota County, Jim Backstrom, has had this bill drafted for us, and we have several people here that I'd like to. Mr. Scott Hersey is here in place of County Attorney Backstrom. Barb Lurshin is from Scott County, and she will have a few comments to say. And the family of of the gal who lost her life in an accident from a careless driver is to my right, and they are. Eileen and Mike. She's got a brother, and I keep getting them confused. Eileen and Mike are here to fill you in on some of the grief they've gone through. The bill actually asks that a person who drives, operates, or halts a vehicle, as you can read very well, carelessly or heedlessly in disregard of the rights of others or in a manner endangering or likely to endanger property or person.
Senator Parisot, can you pull the mic a little bit closer?
Yeah,
we have to make sure the
sometimes.
Tape gets it. I know.
Okay. Thank you. Including any driver or passenger of a vehicle or other person, and that results in a death, is guilty of a gross misdemeanor. So this brings it up from a simple misdemeanor to a gross misdemeanor. And Clause B says that nothing in this subdivision limits the power of a state to punish persons for conduct constituting a crime under any other law of this state, so it has no. And I would like to think first start with Mr. Hersey.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is Scott Hersey. I'm an assistant Dakota County attorney in the Dakota County Attorney's Office. We are asking the committee to approve this bill, and we specifically are asking because we have had situations where someone has been killed by someone else's careless driving, and we have not been able to charge anything other than a simple charge of careless driving. One of the cases that we had most recently was the case where Mr. and Mrs. Devney's daughter, Jacqueline, was killed. It was July 27th of last year. Jacqueline was college-bound. She was working the summer job with the city of Farmington. She was working on the side of one of the main roadways, and an SUV jumped the curb, struck her, and threw her against a retaining wall and killed her. The driver had fallen asleep at the wheel and hit her at about 50 miles an hour. The driver had worked three overtime shifts, working from 7:30 p.m. to 8 a.m., hadn't slept in 20 hours, and the last time she had slept, she only slept for about 3 to 3.5 hours. We presented this case to the grand jury and asked the grand jury to consider the charges of criminal vehicular homicide based on gross negligence, which is the standard for a non-alcohol-related death, and we also included careless driving. The grand jury only indicted for careless driving because they saw negligence in that situation, but the standard of gross negligence is a very high standard. The requirement is extreme negligence without even scant care. Essentially, the way the current statute of careless driving treats an offense like this is no more serious than someone being negligent and having a fender bender. and the current law doesn't distinguish if a person would drive off the road and hit a traffic sign as opposed to hitting someone's 18-year-old child and killing that person. And we feel that a misdemeanor just doesn't cover this situation. And we've had cases like this over the years, and it's extremely difficult to explain to parents that even though their child was killed by someone's negligent driving, that it would only be a misdemeanor and only be careless driving. And I would ask the committee to consider the fact that under some of the statutes that we have in Minnesota, the severity of the result of the conduct determines the severity of the offense. That's the way we have it in the assault statutes. An assault 5 that requires bodily harm only is a misdemeanor. An assault 3 is when there's substantial bodily harm, and an assault 1, the latter two both being serious felonies, involves great bodily harm. And that's even contained in the criminal vehicular operations statute itself. If there's simply bodily harm, it's a gross misdemeanor, but again, that requires gross negligence if it's not alcohol related. If there's substantial bodily harm, it's a 3-year. Great bodily harm, it's a 5-year maximum felony. With death, there's a 10-year maximum penalty. We do have situations where negligence also is the standard that is determined for gross misdemeanors. We do have a statute that provides that if a person negligently stores a firearm where children might get at the firearm, which would create a substantial risk of harm to the child, that is a gross misdemeanor. We do have a statute where if a person recklessly handles a firearm and does so in a park or school zone where it may injure children, that again is a gross misdemeanor. And based upon comparing this situation and these facts to those particular statutes, we are asking this committee to consider passing this particular statute, which would make it a gross misdemeanor. And a benefit to a gross misdemeanor is that there can be 2 years of probation, longer control by the court, and it would give the court the opportunity to make the penalty fit the crime with such serious results. So we would ask the committee to give this serious consideration. Thank you.
Mr. Hersey, I think you're going to find that you're in front of a friendly committee here. I think the next stop, you're going to have to pull out the law books and do a little work, but you're in front of a friendly committee here. So let's hear from the other testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to go to the family next. Eileen and Mike would have a few words for you.
Our daughter Jacqueline was killed by the careless driver.
Can you state your name for the record,
please? Eileen Devney.
Thank you.
And I'm Mike Devney. It was a perfect day that day. Jackie was hit by a SUV, and she was flown 135 feet in the air up against this retaining wall.
The lady had been sleeping for approximately 2.5 to 3 blocks before she hit her daughter. So it was hard for us to believe that that's not gross negligence when she herself made choices the night before not to sleep, to take her children to the pool, sit in the hot sun all day, spend 12 hours at the VA hospital, and then come home under her own choice to get behind the SUV and drive when she was in such a desperately impaired, sleep-deprived condition. And then our daughter, who wasn't in the wrong place, who was doing her job to earn money to better her education, was struck and killed out of the other lady's negligence.
Yeah, she was going to be she was going to go to University of North Dakota for nursing, but there's several jobs Jackie was capable of doing. Being a nurse, being a teacher. I think one of her best ones would have been an ambassador for the great state of Minnesota. She was a mentor. She was a motivator. She was great. Society has lost a great friend here. It's just terrible.
Mr. and Mrs. Davney, you've got the condolences of everyone on this committee. We routinely have to take testimony from parents and siblings who have lost a loved one, and it's difficult, and you have our condolences.
Thank you.
Sure, please.
Jackie had many, many friends, and not only in school, but she was a high-end 4-H'er, and a lot of people truly miss her a lot. She's a great asset to the community. Chairman and members, we have another witness at the other end of the table who has a story to tell, too, if you have time to hear it.
Mr. Chair?
I'm sorry, Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Parisot, I just wish that your bill had a felony rather than a gross misdemeanor, because it seems to me that what we're talking about is so much more serious than even what's in this. So thank you for bringing forward. And I have to say that I see your pin that on your and so that's beautiful, too. Thank you for sharing your story with us.
Senator Parisot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Barb Lurshin is from Scott County and has a story to tell that's sort of very similar.
Okay. Thank you very much, Senator, and thank you, Senators.
State your name for the record, please.
My name is Barbara Lurshin. I live in Prior Lake in Scott County.
Thank you.
And I would like to introduce you to my son, Michael. This is his picture here. I'm going to put it in front of you. He was only 17. This happened in July of 2004. I wish I could tell you that this gets easier over time, but it doesn't. He was fatally injured in an automobile accident. He was a passenger with a seatbelt on. He hung up upside down in the vehicle until the police, firemen, and paramedics extricated him from the vehicle. The driver was a juvenile who was able to get out of the vehicle and make cell phone calls within 15 minutes of the accident. However, the driver never contacted us. The driver's juvenile status limits our knowledge of the complete punishment received and the juvenile's driving record, and it also limits what I can say today about what happened in the accident. So please forgive me for not going into that more. My son lived 18 hours after the accident. Dozens of his friends and teachers visited Michael in his hospital bed on his last day. The accident took place in Invergrove Heights, and he was at Children's in St. Paul. He was unconscious the entire time. I held his hand when he died, and then was whisked by the hospital staff to my own hospital room. I was having chest pains off and on during the day, but I didn't want to leave his side. My husband was with Michael until his body went cold. Michael's friends in Prior Lake quickly raised money to make these T-shirts. Can you help me? And over 50 were made. In fact, they absconded with the photograph that we expected to put on top of the coffin because of Michael's injuries. We were afraid we would have to have closed coffin. These same friends organized a Mikey birthday party. It would have been his 18th birthday, and that was held 13 days after his funeral. Michael's high school friends made a presentation of Michael to Care 11 TV. They also included Michael on page 3 of their yearbook here. The entire page was dedicated to Michael. They included Michael in their graduation ceremony the following June, when he would have graduated in June of 2005. St. Paul Pioneer Press had a nice article on the graduation ceremony and on the accident, plus there was front page coverage in our local Prior Lake American newspaper. There were approximately 300 at the wake and 200 at the funeral and luncheon. The Marine Corps showed up in dress blues at the wake and the committal service at Fort Snelling. One sergeant gave us his own personal hat. Just a minute, please. After we had the final service, he came up and asked permission of my husband to give us to him because Michael said he always wanted one. Michael wanted to go into the Marine Corps. He was drilling. He was doing PT with the Marines. He was very strong. He was skinny but strong. And he was begging me to meet with him during the last week of his life. I foolishly said, wait till your 18th birthday, never dreaming that he wouldn't have it. This and memories are all we have left of Michael. He's buried at Fort Snelling because of two reasons. My husband and I planned to be buried there. My husband was a sergeant in the Marine Corps, and we knew that Michael would have earned his own way, so all of us at sometime will be together. In Minnesota, you're guilty of a misdemeanor if you disclose information on an accident report or if you kill someone while driving carelessly. I believe in killing someone in an auto accident is a much more serious crime than revealing what's in an accident report. It should at least be a gross misdemeanor, if not a felony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am. And once again, our condolences go out to the families, and all too often this happens, and it doesn't quite seem like the punishment does fit the crime. And hopefully Senator Parisot will prevail in the endeavor to try and make this as right as possible. Are there any questions from the committee? Is there anyone else that wants to testify on Senate File 605?
Senator, can I just say
yes,
word?
Sir.
How special Jackie was. She was in the Dakota County 4-H project, and she was in the sheep project. And for you people that are involved in the 4-H, we have a 4-H auction every year at our fair. That was about 2 weeks afterwards. There was $27,000 raised by a sheep. That's fair. And a lot of the kids that are in the 4-H actually donated their premium back towards that. They took their premium they got and they gave it back. That's a her.
A lot of friends are missing a lot of people.
Yeah. Senator Ortman moves that Senate File 605 be recommended to pass and re-referred. Senator Parisot, this bill needs to go to Judiciary.
Senator Moore's committee, right?
Right. So Senator Ortman moves that Senate File 605 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Further discussion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Parisot. And to the families that came, thanks for having the courage to come today and give us your testimony. And once again, we are our condolences go out to your families.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Need a sign or not?
Uh, Senator Sieben, Senate File 966.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chair and members, first I have a delete all amendment I'd like to offer. It's the A1 amendment.
Senator Sieben, why don't you start explaining the A1 amendment while we're passing it out, because it is a little bit, looks like the amendment's a little longer than your original bill.
Right. Mr. Chair and members, essentially what this bill does, which is Senate File 966, is it clarifies that an individual must have both a valid driving privileges and an unexpired license in order to operate a vehicle in Minnesota. And the reason this bill came forward was there was a court challenge where someone had an expired but valid driver's license. And the delete all amendment they made some changes in the House bill, which I think it doesn't change the intent of the language of the original bill, but they did this just to clarify that it conformed to all the various statutes.
All right. I know that Ms. McCormick is in the room. This is a vehicle services initiative. Is that correct, Senator Sieben?
Yes, sir.
All right. On the adoption of the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 966 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail.
Thank you.
Next, let's take Senator Carlson, Senate File 1181. I don't see Senator Carlson. He was just here. Well, then let's start on Senator Moore. Senator Moore, let's start at the top of the list here with Senate File 1296.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Mr. Chair, thank you for accommodating me. The Judiciary Committee just ended our adjourned from our committee. I have three bills, so I'm a little bit dumb. I have a lot of stuff. Senate File 1296, Mr. Chair, is a bill that we have I've presented in the committee, and we've already added as an amendment to the two omnibus bills that left the committee, the finance omnibus bills, and I believe there's an author's amendment.
For A1.
And the
it's the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A1 amendment as my author's amendment to put the bill in the shape I would like it to be in.
Okay. Could you just explain what it does?
Yes.
They're handing it out, yeah.
Yes. Mr. Chair, the A1 amendment is almost a technical correction to the bill. I've been working with the community as well as the department on this bill, and the A1 amendment is feedback from the department that the language we have in the bill needs to change in some areas to be in conformity with federal language. And then there's one sentence in there that is comfort language for the department as well as for the stakeholders in terms of how much of the federal funds could practically be used for workforce development under current currently and as we ramp up to the full use of all available federal funds.
Okay, Senator Malone moves the amendment. Is there any questions or comments on the amendment? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Carried.
Mr. Chair and members, Section 1 of Senate File 1296 addresses the highway construction training issue. We've heard from the department earlier when they were testifying that, and I asked the question, that currently under federal law, Minnesota, any state actually, is permitted to use up to half of 1% of federal funds that is available under United States Code Title 23 to develop, conduct, and administer highway construction training. And at the current time, we are not quite able to use up the entire half of 1%, but we would like to work towards that goal. And so that's the reason why we've put in the language about the maximum feasible amount. The second part of Section 1 asks for the department to report back to this committee describing the program and how it's doing and the amount and where they're going in terms of the training goals. Section 2 of the bill just asked the department to report to the committee on how they're doing with disadvantaged business enterprise programs. The department has looked at this bill. As I mentioned before, the amendment was incorporated in their concerns and their input, and I don't think there's any opposition to it. I have with me tonight Ms. Sarah Mullins, who works with ISAIAH, and the highway construction training program is one of the areas that ISAIAH cares very much about. Have been doing a lot of work, not just in Minnesota, but in other states. And she liked to speak very quickly to this issue, just to have it on the record, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today. We do have... just say the other names that are down on the agenda here are people who are also in support of this that ISAIAH has been working with from the training community, contractors, and the labor trades, but they were, with the changes in the timing of this meeting, not able to make it tonight. So my name is Sarah Mullins, and I represent ISAIAH, which is an interfaith coalition of 85 congregations and over 50,000 people in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the suburbs, and St. Cloud. As people of faith, we recognize that our destinies are intertwined with those of the residents of all over the state. We are one community. We're also very pragmatic, so we seek tangible ways to live in community with one another. At 7 large public gatherings involving over 4,000 people last fall, ISAIAH leaders discussed the opportunity to use federal dollars to train people in our communities for transportation construction jobs, good living wage jobs in our neighborhoods. As we see it, our transportation system is our greatest ongoing public works project. Every year, we invest in building or repairing our transportation system. And every year, we should invest in connecting our community members to opportunities to train for these jobs. Congress thinks so, too, so they authorize states to use the 0.5%, 1.5% of federal transportation dollars for recruitment, training, and retention of underrepresented workers into these construction jobs. Still, it remains for states to commit to using the funds. Last year, Isaiah's sister affiliate in St. Louis forged a precedent-setting agreement with the Missouri Department of Transportation on the largest transportation project in the state's history, the I-64 rebuild. The agreement included an RFP for recruitment and training programs, as well as incentives for contractors to hire underrepresented workers. Community groups, labor trades, and contractors signed on to this legally binding agreement. Our congregations have people who want to train for these kinds of jobs. However, not every one of them would pass a screening test if they had to take it today. We see that it's a moral imperative to reach out to people where they're at, to remove the barriers so that all can access the opportunity to train for these jobs. What I mean is largely support services, things like support for getting your GED, a math catch-up class, transportation or childcare, the kinds of things that trainees really need so that they can commit to completing the training and that they can be successful once placed in the job. With Senate File 1296, Minnesota makes an ongoing commitment to training new workers and opening access to all Minnesotans. We see that there's mutual benefit. The trainee gets a living wage job, and the state gets trained employees ready to build Minnesota's roads. We have a model from Missouri and other states. South Carolina and Maine do this currently, and Michigan and Pennsylvania are going through a similar process of committing to do this now. And as I said before, Isaiah is working with all of the stakeholders. And I really do believe we share a common vision of what this training could really do for Minnesota residents. So I ask for your support on this bill. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Bonner?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moi, since we have voted on this bill and it's included in the omnibus bill, is it here before us because of the amendment?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonhoff, I'm not sure what Senator Murphy's intentions about the bills tonight, but I know that it's in the omnibus bill. I don't know what's going to be happening in negotiations with the omnibus bill. If this committee likes the idea and we vote on it again, I really would like to have it proceed on its own.
Thank you.
Its companion is going dual track, and so I'd like to have a companion of it hit the floor.
Thanks.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Moi, and Ms. Mullins. I think the reason we need it to travel on its own, you made a good, compelling testimony. It's a good bill on its own for some job training opportunities and some education.
Any further questions or comments? Senator Moi moves that Senate File 1296 be recommended to pass and go to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried. Want to take your next bill?
Mr. Chair, I believe the next bill is Senate File 984?
986.
Okay, go ahead.
986.
984?
84. You want to take 86 or 84?
84. 84.
Okay, okay.
They're both very simple bills, Mr. Chair. Senate File 984 is a one-paragraph bill. At the beginning of the legislative session in the department's briefings, they came to us and they spoke with us about the federal Real ID and how difficult it would be in implementation. And, in fact, that the federal government hasn't even come out with rules yet. And we heard in that testimony, Mr. Chair and members, of what the cost would be to the state of Minnesota. The one-time cost to get it implemented alone will be $10.3 million, and ongoing costs are about $21.23 million over a five-year period, which will be required to fully implement the Real ID Act. Suffice it to say, we don't have this kind of money. I think that the department has already, or DVS, has indicated to us that it is problematic to try to implement. At the current time, the federal government has set a deadline of May 2008 for implementation. I think that in recent activities in Congress, they've graciously allowed us to petition for an extension to December 31st of 2009.
And in that extension, in that piece of legislation, they've also graciously allow us to use at least up to 20% of our Homeland Security dollars to help us implement this act. I think this is a federal mandate that that just does not work, and DVS has testified to that. So this simple bill, Mr. Chair and member, is just to say that the state of Minnesota won't implement the Real ID. As of February 12th, the state of Minnesota became number 38 of 39 states that have joined a coalition of states that will not implement the Real ID. Those 39 states have either put in a bill or have already passed either a bill or a binding resolution to do exactly what this bill is trying to do tonight. So, Mr. Chair, members, the language of the bill is pretty simple.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Moy, I was curious about the authority that you cite in the bill to keep Real ID from being implemented. And I was wondering, is this the same kind of language that's been used in other states that have passed either a law or a binding resolution referencing the 10th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I was wrestling with how to best do it, and it's a little bit of looking at what other states have done, and it's a little bit of asking Senate counsel to help draft something that is familiar or consistent with what we do here in Minnesota. And so it's a little bit of a combination.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
So other states have made an appeal through a petition to the Constitution, as well as just generally public policy that they do not are not comfortable with the federal mandate on Real ID at this time.
Yes. Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, that's right. And in the state of Missouri, where Senator James Guest, Representative James Guest, who is a Republican representative, is the one who's leading the charge on this coalition of states against Real ID. In their state, in their binding resolution, they're even proposing to give authority to their attorney general to sue the federal government from enforcing this or imposing this on their state. And I didn't go that far. I just think that it's this issue has a life of its own at the federal level. I wanted to give our department the peace of mind that as a state we have recognized that it's an issue.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Moy. I am a co-author on the bill, and I believe in its purpose. I'm just wondering if you might be amenable to line 1.6 through the first comma on line 1.8. Although it does give us a purpose statement, I'm just not one that likes to have to put purpose statements into statute. So I think we get the statutory authority on everything after that comma where it starts out the Commissioner of Public Safety is prohibited. Do we need the purpose statement in there, Senator Moy?
Mr. Chair and Senator Jungbauer, whatever the committee would like to do, I am open to whatever will make this stick.
Then, Mr. Chair.
Senator Jungbauer.
I would move to amend Senate File 984 by deleting everything in line 1.6 up into the first comma in line 1.8. Again, members, I feel it's just a purpose statement, and we get right to the meat of what we're trying to do here with everything after that.
Mr. Chair.
I would accept that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I'm just disappointed Senator Fischbach didn't get to it first.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Fischbach, I take it that was going to be your suggestion.
Mr. Chair, exactly. So I am very happy, though, that Senator Jungbauer has learned something to take those things up. So.
Senator Olsen.
If we hang for this, will we all hang together?
I've been hanging with you all session, Senator Olsen.
On the Jungbauer motion to amend, striking lines 1.6, 1.7, and then the language to the comma in 1.8. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion, no. Motion does prevail. And Senator Moi moves that Senate file 984 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. Is there anybody here that wants to speak in opposition to the bill? Seeing none on that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you. Senator Moi, you have Senate file 986.
Mr. Chair, Senate file 986 came to me from the department. It is a technical correction to be in compliance with federal, to meet federal requirements. You know, the department is here to answer questions, but I've asked counsel in the Judiciary Committee to take a look at this. I don't know what counsel in the Transportation Committee thinks about this, but it looks like it's pretty technical to put us in conformity with federal requirements.
Right. And Senator Moi, is your committee going to need to see this?
I don't think so, Mr. Chair. I think that it relates directly to driver's licenses and clarification of definitions.
Okay. Is there somebody from the department that wishes to make a statement? Come join us.
Senator Murphy, members, my name is Joan Kupczynski. I'm the Driver Services Director. Again, the bill is simply, I've got the wrong one in front of me. It's based on an audit issue that we had, and what we're trying to do is just become compliant with federal regulations or federal guidelines.
Okay. Is there anybody that wants to testify against the bill? I don't see any, so Senator Wah moves that Senate file 986 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate floor. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That was the Senator Wah legislative agenda for the year. Senator Carlson, I believe you're up next. We'll go Senator Carlson on Senate File 1181, and then we're going to take Senator Dibble's Bill 1534.
Mr. Chair and Committee, I'm bringing you Senate File 1181, which is an agency bill for driver's license requirements expansion. What this does is put the information in statute that's already actually on my driver's license, and that's the class endorsements and restrictions. And I have Ms. Kupczynski here to also speak to this bill.
Mr. Chair, members, the bill is simply asking us to codify the requirement for display of a license, class endorsement, or restriction on a license. As the senator mentioned, it is already on the license. We're just seeking legislative or statutory authority.
Mm-hmm. This is a pretty simple bill, and this just puts the statute into basically it kind of reflects what we already do.
That is correct, Mr.
Right.
Chair.
So, Senator Carlson, is there anybody who wants to testify against the bill? Seeing none, Senator Carlson moves that Senate File 1181 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Senate consent calendar. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion does prevail. Thank you, Senator Carlson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll straighten out while you're.
Yes.
Senator Dibble, it's my understanding that you've got a delete all amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have the A3 amendment.
It's the A3?
Yeah, the A3. unless Senate Council tells me something different. It's A3. Mr. Chair, this bill was heard previously in Senator Rest's subcommittee. This is a bill has two major parts to it. It has to do with railway safety issues. The first part of the bill, Mr. Chair, establishes it brings Minnesota into the federal rail safety program. Establishes an assessment and then establishes the position of a state railway inspector in the state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, I'll call the members' attention to this blue packet. We did have a couple of days ago at our hearing, we had a representative of the Federal Railroad Administration who was here to encourage
Senator
us
Dibble,
to
do everybody
that.
Has a copy of the A3 amendment. Let's adopt the A3 amendment. Senator Dibble moves the A3 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion does prevail. Senator Dibble.
I thought the letter was in here. Well, it's somewhere in your packet where they speak very favorably towards the establishment of a state railway inspector and explain how that is not a duplication of federal duties, that it's an important link between the state and the railroad workers and the railway companies and the federal government. The second part, Mr. Chair, establishes some walkway safety standards, the establishment of walkways for workers along the sides of railway in a whole variety of circumstances, and speaks to some of the particularities of each of those circumstances. It's all very geometric in nature and very specific in nature, but it has to do with making sure that walkways are established and kept clean and free of debris for the purpose of safety. This is an initiative brought forward by the UTU. It's a part of a national effort that they're doing in a variety of states, Mr. Chair, and with that, I have Mr. Phil Qualley from the UTU who can explain a little further the goals of this bill.
Ms. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you very much for hearing this bill this afternoon. My name is Philip Qualley. I'm State Legislative Director for the United Transportation Union, or UTU. I have over 25 years as a railroad conductor, trainman, remote control locomotive operator, and yard master on the former Chicago Northwestern Railroad and the Union Pacific. And, Mr. Chairman, Senators, before I proceed, I would just like to say on opening note here that as my job as state legislative director, about 80% of what I do is railroad safety. And I take no joy bringing this matter before the state's attention. However, this bill is necessary, and I hope that by the end of our presentation I can answer any questions you have and hope and impress upon you the duty to protect not only worker safety but the public safety. Again, as Senator Dibble, and I'd also like to thank Senator Dibble for carrying this bill. I'd like to point out that in the cover letter to you, Mr. Chairman, we've outlined the nugget of this issue and the benefits we see bringing this legislation forward. We have a strong letter of support from Federal Associate Administrator Joe Strang, the second in command at the Federal Railroad Administration. I do thank the committee chairman for allowing the UTU to be here Tuesday with Federal Inspector Michael Calhoun that was sent here. We also have to support the state creation of this reestablishment of the state inspector. We have General Counsel's letter in support, as well as a letter from the state of Wisconsin that shows how they assess the state inspectors there. I'll quickly walk through what the bill does, and then I'll speak to the amendments that have been made to build a better bill. I will then refer to this packet and explain to you how we've tried to build this bill and what it means, and speak to the issue of preemption, if I may, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Qualley.
Thank you. The Senate File 1534 Railroad Walkway Bill is a worker and public safety bill. It calls for the reestablishment of one state rail safety inspector through the officer of the Commissioner of MnDOT. We had two state inspectors that were abolished in 1985. calls for the Class 1 railroads in the state to be assessed for the total startup and the reestablishment cost of the safety inspector, and it calls for the commissioner to continue to assess the Class 1s for the ongoing cost for the inspector, as do the states of Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa, do at this time. It should be noted that the administrative avenues for appeal of non-monetary citations will be provided by the the Office of Administrative Hearings, which were part of the abolishment of the Transportation Regulation Board provisions of 1996. The Senate File 1534, as amended, establishes a special fund for MnDOT in the Office of Waterways and Rail. And it also gives short lines and regional railroads a break, if you will. They are not assessed for the cost of the inspector, and they may apply to an OSHA type of MnSharp coaching program or a safety coaching program. We think that the discipline of a state rail inspector will be specifically for track and right-of-way disciplines in the railroad business. They will not be doing motive power, rolling stock, or any other signals or things like that. They will, I believe, as a part of the track, be able to inspect crossing signal systems, as well as all records and associated with that duty. And frankly, the bill gives the commissioner a great deal of flexibility. We've amended the bill in a spirit of compromise. We tried to reach out to the carriers. We let the division presidents know via my letter at the end of November. Each Class 1 carrier in the state last November 15th, asking them to increase their budgets for maintenance of way by 10% and reminding them of the deplorable conditions of the yards and track. The only response we had was to refer to a legislative lobbyist for one of the carriers. We met with the carriers after the first of the year, beginning a session, continued to meet with MnDOT throughout this period of time, and had good conversations. We have compromised with our amendments to reduce their cost, although we disagree with their cost estimates. The key areas that have been changed in the A3 amendment provide for proper federal citation for the creation of the state rail safety inspector. We've streamlined the methodology for assessing the Class 1 carriers equally after speaking with MnDOT again. And we've greatly reduced the walkway defective equipment or trackside warning area detector provision from 2 miles down to 300 feet within a 2 mile stretch of a track wayside detector. Defective equipment detector. We've eliminated ambiguous language, and we've deleted a provision regarding bridges, and frankly, we've just done the best we can to make this bill as palatable as possible. I would like to quickly speak to the nature of the problem. In your blue book, you'll see some facts I'll refer to in a minute, but essentially, from the FRA fact base, during a period between January 1, 2003 and December 31, 2006, there were 187 non-fatal injuries that have occurred to rail workers in the state of Minnesota. From a study of FRA statistics and from our own members' testimony, over 20% of these injuries can be characterized as slip, trip, and fall FRA-type reportable injuries. And I want to be clear that these are not injuries where they give someone a Band-Aid and an aspirin and send them home for a day. These are where medical treatment is prescribed, prescription drugs are prescribed, there is lost time, and there is ongoing medical treatment. And these are just the injuries we know about. I can tell you of my 1,200 members, there are many railroad workers walking around with sore legs, hips, knees, and ankles. What is contributing to these are uneven ballast, slipping hazards, and obstructions in the walkways. And from our experience on the railroads, the carriers are simply not cleaning up the safety hazards. As part of my duty as state director, I monitor the progress of state rail safety committees, carrier safety committees that are on property, voluntary committees on each of the Class 1 properties. What we're finding is they are not getting the stuff cleaned up. Our members go into the safety committees, they report the problems out in the field, but the carriers are not taking action. Finally, at that point, it becomes necessary to introduce legislation to protect our workers. The carrier has a non-delegable duty to provide a safe work environment, and we believe that it's in state interest to protect worker and public safety. Walking through your handout, if I may, you'll see that page one just shows that 30 states presently have state rail safety inspectors. We have a breakdown of Wisconsin, Illinois, and Iowa on how they pay for them. We page two has a year FRA year-end summary of train accidents caused by track defects. Note that in that four-year period, there were 117 derailments in Minnesota that were caused by track, totaling over $13 million of damage. Page three, you'll note that we have a 2007 FRA printout of statistics from state inspectors that shows that the areas that this bill seeks to improve, turnouts of main track and turnouts of yard track, are 14% defect rate at this time, and a staggering 70% defect of records not being kept on the condition of the tracks in the state. Finally, through our handout, you'll see a SOFA operating casualty pyramid, which is a switching operations fatality analysis, and the base of the pyramid is highlighted. That was page four, where you see that 20% of the injuries are slip, trip, and fall. We break it down further on page five and six of all the different types of injuries that have occurred and the different actions. And finally, on page eight, I have blotted out the railroad this came from, but here's safety carrier meeting minutes, where you see in the far right-hand column they're simply not getting things fixed. Finally, on page nine, we have created a diagram for each of the pieces of the bill that are very concise and shows that what our bill seeks to do is says to the railroads, clean up the tracks of debris, of the rotten feed, and so on and so forth. The debris in the tracks are a real hazard to the workers who are controlling movements of rail. And it says when you do go into specific areas and resurface or repair the track or otherwise, you leave it in conditions with a ballast walkway. And I can't overemphasize that this bill, that is only when they go in to fix those areas. There's an exemption on all track until such a time they go in to fix those areas. We think it's reasonable and fair. Finally, this book has pictures that are just a fraction of the pictures that have been submitted to this committee from around the state from our members. And I assure you are indicative of the conditions of yards and track around this state. I just want to very quickly say that, again, the second portion of this bill, while it looks very technical, for those of us in the railroad business, it is very concise and specific. I think I've outlined that. This language was taken from the state of Nevada, Oregon, California, and Tennessee, where they have already put this type of language into state statute and did survive the test of federal preemption in the Ninth Circuit Court. Finally, regarding preemption, we've taken the same language. We believe the way it's crafted, we can survive the always present issue of federal preemption. I think we've touched on how we've helped streamline the cost of this. But I would like to mention that much of the maintenance that we need in this state is standard upkeep that has been deferred. And we did not have this problem of debris and some of the things you see in the pictures before about 6 to 8 years ago. Also, the carriers have mentioned, we think it's a standard good workplace hygiene, but I ask you to keep in mind respectfully, Mr. Chairman and committee members, our guys that are working on the railroad are controlling movements with either radio or in the dark with a lantern or remote control locomotive where we have a belt back, a lantern, a radio, moving on and off the equipment, watching numbers rolling in the yards, and we have bad walking conditions and track conditions. One of our members fail. One of our members falls, and that movement keeps, it does not stop in time. We have a collision. And if that movement has hazardous materials, we now have an event, and if those hazardous materials should happen to be ruptured and released, whether it's a low speed inside a yard or mainline out on a high-speed collision. I believe it's in state's interest to protect the public safety. Finally, going back to the cost of this bill, we think that this bill will save the carriers money. If we reduce one or two injuries under our Federal Employee Liability Act compensation system, what the carriers are assessed each year is easily saved by what an injured worker goes through and what they pay out in compensation claims. The railroads have mentioned the cost of the ballast. Well, we know that the Canadian National will give the ballast or the small three-quarter-inch rock to build their walkways and smooth out the yards free from the taconite plants. The Union Pacific owns their own quarries. The Burlington Northern Santa Fe owned a quarry where the predecessor railroad in St. Cloud on the Great Northern, but just last year sold off that track to a short line, and we do know that the Burlington Northern gets their ballast from quarries that are non-revenue movements through FRA investigation. I want to thank you for your patience. I'm going to close very quickly here. The legislative history of this, again, we did contact the carriers after monitoring safety committees for 2 years on their lack of progress. We met at the beginning of the session with the lobbyists and let them know that we would be crafting language from the state of Nevada. We have had two meetings with MnDOT. We brought in general chairman so that they could tell MnDOT just how bad it is out in the yard. We've asked for a meeting with the governor. The governor has respectfully declined. And there have been referrals made by the carriers to this law that was passed in Illinois, and I don't believe it is appropriate to characterize another state's legislative movement. However, that good faith that was occurred down in Illinois, that has now been taken by the railroad to federal court on a preemption argument. I hope that you'll see this legislation as an opportunity to fulfill your public and your duty to help protect safety of the workers and the public. And we think that in the third year of record profits for the railroads, after 25 years of the Staggers Act, we've paid a price to help return our industry to profitability. And the railroad's very healthy in their profit. This bill is a good piece of legislation, and there's many, many things that this committee does, Mr. Chairman. I'm part of the lobbyist family, and I'm very proud of the work you do. You do a lot of great things to help move people in this state. But I have to say, here you have the opportunity to protect the public. Thank you very much, and I hope you'll support 1534.
Thank you, Mr. Qualley. Any questions? Senator Olsen.
Can you address the Federal Preemption Act a little more?
Yes. Thank you very much. The railroad business is essentially interstate commerce. And we wanted to make, I guess, the wisdom of this country was to keep regulations uniform in nature. And that just like when you mail a letter, whether you ship a boxcar across the country or whether you send it across the city, we wanted to keep uniformity to assure fairness. The Supreme Court has ruled in federal USC 49 states that under 2106 that a state may adopt or continue. So we have a blanket of safety rules that are federal. And we look for federal compliance. And as I said, most of what I do is railroad safety. Much of my time is spent with federal law. However, in that mindful of that, Federal Code 49 states that a state may adopt or continue in force a law, regulation, or order related to railroad safety or security until the security of transportation with respect to railroad safety matters or the Secretary of Homeland Security with respect to railroad security matters prescribes a regulation or issues an order covering the subject matter that the state of a state requirement. A state may adopt or continue to force an additional or more stringent law, regulation, or order related to railroad safety or the security. If I may say, Minnesota Section 219 is about 60 laws that the state of Minnesota already has on the books. Clearance, crossings, 219.50, which this law or our bill modifies. Those are already on the books. However, for the most part, Senators, Mr. Chairman, they're not being enforced. There's no inspector. So, again, it is within states' right to pass laws to help protect railroad safety and the public safety.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, I might have missed it. Maybe you've mentioned already. You said 6 years ago, this is when these issues started really coming to a head. What changed at that point that all this started occurring?
This is somewhat subjective on my part, but I'll give you my opinion if you'd like, Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Well, Mr. Qualley, if we're going to get into this he said, she said thing, I'd rather you just stick to the facts. If you have a clear-cut fact of why this change started to occur around 5-6 years ago, then we'll hear that. But I know how it is working in the powerhouse. And sometimes these issues of safety come up, and it turns into a kind of he said, she said. But, you know, if you have documented proof, that's what we want to hear. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator, I have two pieces that I think are valuable to the committee, and I will be careful with my caveats. Number one, in the 1990s, during the Clinton years and the Jolene Moliteras administration of the FRA, there was a great effort to build partnerships in railroad industry and to work towards common goals. And the UTU is a part of that, and we applaud that. And in fact, we think that is the best way to go. I take no joy being before you today, Mr. Chairman. What has occurred is then in the mid-90s, under Administrator Moliteras, they set up some working groups, the SACP, Safety Compliance Assurance Project. And all over the United States, we started working groups between labor and management to assure safety compliance and to improve many areas of safety. Very positive development. However, what we've seen and what I have observed is that in the last, many good things came out of that. However, in the last 6 years or so, we've seen the carrier's side of upholding that bargain drop off, where they simply aren't getting things fixed as the committee, are supposed to intend to design to do. The buildup has just been gradual from deferred maintenance. And finally, recently, the Federal Railroad Administration, which used to sit as part of the SACP program, has withdrawn from SACP and sponsoring SACP committees. Now, there's several reasons they state why, but I am aware in my authority as state director that they are dissatisfied with the progress of these safety committees, and I hope that answers your question. I will not get into anything other than beyond that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Further questions? Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Qualley, this is just one issue I'm taking it amongst many that probably you have with the carriers. Isn't there another way to alleviate these problems other than to bring these individual issues and things like that to the legislature? I have a little bit of trouble in that we start taking care of all of these different issues in legislation, you know what I mean.
Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just, draw Senator Gimsey's attention to the letter from the Federal Railroad Administration, which is in this packet. I had it tucked in the blue packet before. That's why I thought it was in the blue packet. So you see the UTU letter, but the second letter is from the Federal Railroad Administration, and we had a representative from the FRA here Tuesday, but we ran out of time on my other fund bill. It's a strong statement of support for Minnesota's reentry into participation in the National Rail Safety Regulatory Program. That's what this bill goal is. So I don't know that we're bringing piecemeal issues before the committee. We're bringing a fairly substantial and important policy change and establishment or reestablishment of a program that was lost a number of years ago, and then trying to address the issue of the walkway safety, which is no small issue itself. So, I guess I don't share your perspective.
Mr. Chair.
Well, Senator Gimsey, did you have some follow-up?
No, that's fine, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Senator Bonner.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I appreciate you bringing it forward because I think at a time when we have many of proposed rail studies in our bill and we're looking at some expansion, we hope significant expansion of rail travel in the state of Minnesota, that now is the time to make sure that our the rail that we have is safe.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I'm looking at page 1, line 19 in the new language. It says that the commissioner, in the exercise of powers granted in this chapter, the commissioner may assess common carriers. What does that mean, assess common carriers?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, that means that, you know, similar to what we do with utility industry, we assess those industries who occupy a particular spot in our economy, who enjoy some special protections and have to, you know, trigger some special attention, special government services. We assess, basically we're going to assess the rail carriers for paying the salary, the position within MnDOT of the railroad safety inspector. Which means, of course, we have to go to finance committee.
Senator Moore, did you have?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Senator Dibble, is there a model? Are we looking? Has this been established in other states, and are we looking to some other regions for a model on how to do the assessment?
Yes. In the final page of your packet of the letters, we're doing something that's done similarly in Wisconsin. I'm not sure if other states do that. Mr. Qualley can.
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, yes, they do. Other states assess the Class 1 carriers in their state. And what we propose here was that the Class 1s would be assessed an equal proportionate amount. Thank you.
And I think Senator Moore's question was the process by that which that assessment occurs. Is this about the same as what they do in Wisconsin or Illinois?
Mr. Chairman, Senators, yes.
Okay. Senator Moore.
And then, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Qualley, given the number of miles of railroad that we have in the state, I see here in Section 2 that we're establishing one inspector. Is that enough? Is one inspector going to be able to do the job adequately? Can you speak to that?
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, Senators.
I can tell that answer's probably not, but
I think, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think number one is one inspector is a good place to start, and I do want to answer your question by simply reciting a general accounting report that was just released from the Congressional Accounting Office that states March 15th, the GAO, that according that FRA inspectors are able to examine less than 0.02% of the total rail operations annually. And that's not 2% or 2 out of 100. That's 1/5 of 1% or 2 out of every 1,000. To answer your question, Senator, I would like to see more inspectors, but out of respect for this institution, the Minnesota Department of Transportation and the railroads, we've asked for one to be modest, quite frankly.
And then, Mr. Chair, Mr. Qualley, on page 1, line 1.34, as a carryover sentence from line 33, it says, to the extent delegated by the commissioner, the inspector may issue citations for violations of this chapter. What kind of citations? Are those kind of civil penalties? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
At this time and in the spirit of Mr. Chairman, Senators, We see a citation as being non-monetary at this time. That's certainly something that could be changed if the state legislature should so choose and deem it necessary at some point in the future.
Well, Mr. Qualley and Senator Moi, this is definitely going to have to come to your committee after it goes back to finance. Because of that, I think that your committee deals with that portion of the bill. Further questions for Mr. Qualley. Also, I believe Mr. Gardner is here. Would you want to come and give us your testimony? Mr. Gardner is from the Department of Transportation, the Minnesota Department of Transportation.
Correct. Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Bill Gardner, Minnesota Department of Transportation, Office of Freight and Commercial Vehicle Operations. We have had an opportunity to review this bill, and we do oppose it. We believe that existing state statutes already address the issue of walkway safety. Minnesota statutes 219.50, 219.51, and 219.53 specifically require clear and safe walkways for railroad employees. They establish penalties for violations. They include a process for correcting violations. And they absolve employees of contributory negligence. Currently, the Federal Railroad Administration uses 9 on-site inspectors in Minnesota to ensure federal safety standards are met.
Can you back up just a little bit? You say that employees are absolved.
There's a provision. I can read the phrase in the legislation if you'd prefer, but it...
No, just give me your layman's version.
It's my understanding that the intent of the statute is to absolve employees of any fault in a claim of that might come against the railroads in this sort of a situation when there might be a defect in walkways. For example, if there's a tripping incident, that it's not deemed to be their fault.
The fault of the railroad?
The fault of the employee.
Of the employee. Okay, so if there was an obstruction there, and as Mr. Qualley said, that they were out in the middle of the night trying to write down the numbers of the cars, and they trip and fall, the railroad would be on the hook.
I can't give you a legal interpretation of that phrase, but there is language which I can read to you in the statute that absolves the employee of negligence in this instance.
Okay, go ahead.
Currently, the FRA does have inspectors in Minnesota, as do the railroads themselves. At one time, MnDOT did belong to the Federal Railroad Administration State Rail Safety Participation Program, where there's 50% federal reimbursement of our costs. We did withdraw from the program when the federal funds were eliminated. We could rejoin the program, but it would effectively be at 100% of state cost. The bill would impose a significant administrative burden on the department, including the likely promulgation of rules to implement it. None of these activities are included in either current or future budgets for the department. So, again, we are in opposition to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner. And members, we do have a fiscal note here that shows that this does have an initial cost of, someplace north of right around $67,000, and then it kind of weans down in the out years. And that must be, Senator Dibble, due to the assessment. And
Mr. Chair, I believe the fiscal note, which I've lost track of, I believe it was written to the first draft of the bill with the $125,000 that was originally sought from the general fund, and that's been taken out of the bill. I don't know where the $67,000 comes from exactly.
That's the net.
But, the bill calls for, like I said earlier, assessment to the Class 1 railroads.
Okay.
The net. Mr. Chair?
$67,000 is the net. Senator Dole.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gardner, I guess my question is, I'm looking at some photos here of a what appear to be some violations of what would be the code, or what I assume is the code, and you say you've got inspectors in place and you've got a system for violations, and yet I'm again assuming that these photos are relatively recent. Is there an explanation why these right in the metro area, a lot of these too, why these would not have been corrected by this point? I don't know if you've seen the photos. They might be in the packet up there, but can you give me some sort of an idea why that might not have been corrected by now?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you're correct that we have been informed of some of these problems by Mr. Qualley and others. Inspectors are federal inspectors. We have not received a formal complaint regarding the conditions on walkways or on tracks. If we were to receive that type of complaint, we would deal with it under existing statute and administrative procedures.
Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, it occurs to me that if we had our own state inspectors, we'd be better positioned to enforce our own state statutes as the Federal Railway Administration asks us to do.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, the photo says that some of these things have been reported. Assuming it's been reported to somebody, but if the feds are waiting for a formal complaint, my question falls to Mr. Qualley is to why a formal complaint hasn't been lodged if that would trigger a response.
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. First of all, you're correct, Senator. Our office writes federal complaints, alleged violations and complaints. However, 49 U.S.C. Code 49 CFR point Part 213 has to do with regulations on track, laws on track. That portion is very general and does not break down with specificity so many of these items. And that is how the federal blanket works. And today, Mr. Chairman, I didn't happen to bring my 49 book with me. It's what we call the Bible for the railroad, about that thick. What I would like to add as well is that these have been reported to carrier safety committees and have been written up to division presidents of that railroad for years with no effective response. And finally, if I may comment, there are 9 state rail safety inspectors, only 2 for track, and I will tell you that in my dealings with them, they have asked for help from the UTU. I please reference the letter from Joe String, the federal deputy administrator, in your packet. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Qualley didn't answer my question. Have a complaint been lodged about these? I mean, it's been reported, but what I'm hearing you say is you haven't formally lodged a complaint. And so they're saying because a complaint hasn't been lodged, we can't respond. In the meantime, you're here saying to us these situations are not being addressed and our workers' safety are at stake. I'm not catching the disconnect here, and it's making me prickly.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I apologize. The federal code is ambiguous on these type of straight-up standards for bridge railing.
Well, Mr. Qualley,
they have a clause that they can make a complaint under. I think that's what
you're
saying.
Mr. Chair.
Wait a minute. Senator Moore.
Are you, Ms. Qualley, are you saying that you don't have a specific clause under which you can make complaints that are specific to these situations?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have a specific ability to write violations and complaints to the Federal Railroad Administration when we find a specific piece of the federal code is in violation. On this specific piece, on the bridge, for example, there is nothing specific on bridge railings. On debris between the track, it is nearly silent. And and to be quite honest with you, Mr. Chairman and Senator, I'm learning every day from that federal code. But to answer your question, we do not have if I could have written that up to the federal code, I assure you I would have. And I don't have anything to hang my hat on when I write that violation.
So, Mr. I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name, Mr.
Gardner.
Gardner? Mr. Gardner, you are aware that there are these situations in existence. You say you're waiting for a complaint. But it's my understanding from Mr. Qualley that a complaint can't be lodged because there's no vehicle to lodge that complaint. Why did you state that you couldn't respond to it because no complaint has been lodged?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have not received a formal complaint on this. We do believe there is a state process for handling such complaints. I'm not sure if Mr. Qualley was referring to a federal process or standards to which he could use a judgment of whether or not there was a violation. I'm not certain.
Mr. Chair, this bill is coming to my committee.
Yes.
And the responses that I'm getting is not satisfactory.
Senator Moi, I agree. I don't think the responses from Mr. Qualley or Mr. Gardner quite meet muster. Mr. Gardner, help me with this. If Mr. Qualley just wrote you a little letter and said, hey, why don't you take a little walk through the Shakopee Yard and at marker 67, take a little look around and see what you see, what would you do?
Mr. Chair, we do not do inspections of railroad property. That is the regulatory authority of the Federal Railroad Administration. We have an administrative process where if a formal complaint is brought to us, mm-hmm. there will be hearings and so forth and evidence presented.
Well,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Gardner, to that point, if okay, so what you're saying is Mr. Qualley could send you a letter saying we've got a complaint in the Shakopee Yard, for example, and it's this, that, and the other. You wouldn't go out there to do any investigative work, or that's not the purview of your department?
Mr. Chair, we would, as part of that process, obviously have to look into the complaints in one manner or another. Frankly, we don't have inspectors on staff to do a formal inspection of the condition, but it would have to be investigated and some kind of response made to that. Frankly, we've never been through this process because we haven't received the complaints thus far.
Well, I probably imagine after this hearing you're going to receive some complaints, so I hope that you're ready to put your boots on and head on out to those rail yards. Senator Skoy.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Gardner,
where would the complaint come from if you can't do it? And there's no inspector in Minnesota to do it. And, you know, where would the complaint come from?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I presume the complaint would come from the railroad workers or others who are using that property, contractors and so forth.
But, Mr. Chair, we just heard from them that there's no provisions in the federal college or rules or whatever they're talking about that address these things that these pictures are showing.
Mr. Chair, Senator, there is a state process by which concerns about the existing statutes requiring clear and safe walkways can be brought to us and judged in an administrative process.
And so, Mr. Chair, then the railroad worker who's walking on the walkway that's got a problem would have filed a state complaint. The process for the state would have complaints, and then they would come to you, and then you would investigate.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's correct. Or if they felt there was a violation of federal rules in this area, they could file a complaint with the Federal Railroad Administration.
Mr. Chair, I'll be one more if you don't mind.
Go right ahead.
So the complaint comes in, but you don't have an inspector on staff, and the other ones are federal. So who's going to do the assessment of the problem?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we haven't been through that complaint process yet, so we would have to find a way to obviously investigate the situation and make a determination, either through a contractor or somebody on staff who we felt was competent to look into that situation, whatever it was.
Thank you.
Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Bonoff.
Mr. Qualley, when you write things here that say things like this has been reported for over 3 years, to whom?
To the railroad safety, excuse me, to the railroad company. When I have something that I don't, when I can't write a federal violation or alleged violation complaint to the federal government, a Federal Railroad Administration, I write a letter to the railroad company. My office, the Office of the United Transportation Union, is full of files of unanswered letters from the railroad companies, and so we report them to the carrier because they have the non-delegable duty under the Federal Railroad Safety Act of 1970 to repair those items, but they don't.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Qualley, has it never been considered to report it directly to the state?
Mr. Chairman and Senators, quite frankly, honestly, no. Because what we write is federal, and there is no state overview or presence whatsoever.
Okay.
Senator Dibble.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I think we heard from Mr. Gardner that there's no clear way that the state would know how to handle it. He just basically said to us that they'd have to kind of make it up if they did get a complaint.
Well, that's Senator
what I think
Dibble,
we're trying to solve.
I'm sitting here and I'm looking at Chapter 219.5, and it's pretty clear. And Mr. Sweeney and others, I hope you're listening, but it says the space between and beside the tracks that is ordinarily used by employees in the discharge of their duties and is within 8.5 feet of the center line of the track to become or remain obstructed by a foreign obstacle that will interfere with the work of the employees or subject the employees to unnecessary hazard. Basically, it says that's a violation of law. And Mr. Qualley, you need to tell the Department of the Transportation. You need to file a complaint to the commissioner. Because right here it says in subdivision 3 of 219.51, the commissioner shall lodge with the attorney general information of any violation as may come to their knowledge. And then we'll let the attorney general take care of it. So this is a two-way street here. I want to hear from the railroads. If you guys want to get up here to the bat rack, come on up, because I think we're fired up and ready to go.
We borrowed a chair.
And members, this bill's not going to go to finance. This bill costs $17,000 the first year and $2,000 every year after that. We're going to make sure that when we pass our bill, Mr. Gardner, that your office gets a little bit more money. All right, how's that? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Apitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer, and I represent the Minnesota Regional Railroads Association, an association of short line and regionals here in the state. And we will be brief. You've gone on for quite a while, but just a couple things to say. To Senator Bonoff, there is a renewed interest in the state of Minnesota in railroads. We've heard about the Rush Line. We've heard about the Red Rock, the North Star, the Southwest Corridor, the North Shore Express, the Hiawatha Line. There's lots of interest in railroads. And if everything that was said here is true, everything that was said here is as it is, I'd stop thinking about railroads right now. But I want to just take 2 minutes to reassure you that the railroads in this state are safe and the railroads in this country are safe. As a matter of fact, it's kind of ironic that we're sitting here tonight talking about the disregard for safety on railroads when the Federal Railroad Administration and the Railroad Association of America announced just last week that this is the safest year railroads have had in their whole 175-year history.
Mr. Appas, does that include worker safety?
Mr. Chairman, the nation's railroads experienced their safest year in history in 2006, according to three key safety measurements released by the Federal Railroad Administration. In addition, last year was also the safest year on record for railroad employees, with both injuries and fatality numbers and rates reaching the lowest point in history. And this is just a quote from the president of the American Railroads, making it even more impressive is the fact that rail traffic is at the highest point in history, and thousands of new employees have been brought on board to help handle the record volumes. We move more freight with fewer accidents. That's the case last year.
Well, Mr. Appas, you know, that's true on our highways, too. We had a very successful year last year, and we dropped the fatality count down by 40 or 50, which is a move in the right direction.
Correct.
So it seems like you guys want to do the right thing. Why is Mr. Qualley here with a packet full of pictures that shows that there are that this 8.5 foot from center line, obstruction-free work zone, if you will, is, he's got a whole packet full of pictures. And before you answer, Mr. Appas, you know where I work, and you know that I am within about 50 yards of your railroad, and I walk up and down those tracks all the time. And I see a lot of timber piled up.
Railroad ties. Exactly. If I may, Mr. Chairman, let me just continue one step further and see if I can answer your question in that fashion. Because we did add into the packet some other stuff that isn't a lot of pictures that I might just refer to, and then I'll try to get specifically to your question by just using the materials that Mr. Qualley has provided to the committee. Here's a quick picture of what the rail system in Minnesota looks like. There's about 4,500 miles of track. There are about 5,000 employees in the state of Minnesota. There's four major railroads like Bryan's here, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. There's about 17 smaller railroads that are part of my association. You can see our logos there. And by gosh, you can even go to the website and learn more about us if you want. That's on the very back. Everybody's got to advertise a little bit. But we move a lot of freight in this state. I think the estimate was about 33 to 40% of the freight that's moved in this state. And again, I go to the point that was made just a moment ago about this being the safest year that we've had. The injuries, Mr. Chairman, that take place on the railroads are injuries that occur in a couple of places. They're injuries that occur to people who trespass on the railroads, and we've been in and we've talked about this issue before, and we'd sure like to talk about it again. You got to keep.
Well, I do believe that we stiffened the law a little bit at one time for the railroads for about people that trespass.
About 4 years ago, Mr. Chairman, you did a heck of a good job of that in the rail yards themselves, and hopefully we can keep people off other areas that perhaps Mr. Qualley is referencing in terms of detection devices and other things like that. But it's at grade crossings where the public goes on, drives around the gates, or it's at walking up and down the tracks when we'd like them not to be there, that they get hurt. That's what this little thing tells you. That's what the pie chart says. 97% of the rail fatalities happen not to railroad workers, but to other people who are on the tracks, folks we'd like to keep off. We can look at these other charts, but Mr. Chairman, I'd submit to you that looking at this as an industry, certainly we got our problems. We've got issues. Some of the stuff you see in these pictures is there. It's not made up, but it's there, it's reported, and it's removed. That's what we do to keep the workplace safe. And I heard said that we apparently don't respond to any sort of complaints or incidences that are brought forward. Let me tell you how it works inside the railroad. Bryan and others can help you as well and go specifically to your question, Mr. Chairman. one of the reasons, Mr. Dahl, that we, Senator Dahl, that we that we've seen sort of, I think, a reduction in the amount of problems, fatalities, issues that have arisen is because we have safety committees that exist and were part of Secretary Molinaro's emphasis several years back in formation. What we do is we bring together management and rail workers like Mr. Qualley and other members of his organization, and we sit down monthly and we talk about what's going on out there in terms of safety issues. That's what we're talking about. I think that's what we're talking about here, reports that come from the safety committees. Now, it isn't just a piece of paper that people write on. It's a piece of paper that talks about the project description, the date it was presented, the action taken, who was supposed to do something, the progress taken, and when it got done. And it happens with each one of these safety committees. And the management that is responsible to work with the safety committees are graded on this. Their pay depends on fulfilling, accomplishing these tasks. And I guess I missed the point of this particular sheet, Mr. Chairman, because the complaint is at Dock 1 switches. The switches on the dock were worn out and hard to throw. The assignment went to engineering, and these were adjusted and recommended for an upgrade. The task was accomplished.
Mr. Appice,
I'm sorry.
It was recommended for an upgrade. Did that upgrade occur?
Apparently, the date it was completed was on the 8th of November, 2006. I can go through all this. We don't need to do that, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to suggest is that's the procedure that's used internal. Part of the reason you don't have a lot of complaints coming to Mr. Gardner or very frequently over to the Federal Railroad Administration is because we take care of them at home. That's the best place to stop injury. And I just heard a lot of accusation leveled against railroads for not doing that. I'm telling you the process. We had a gentleman here last evening because we had the same discussion over in the other body who said safety committees work. That's one piece. The defect book is in the yard in each location. When you come off the job and there's a defect, you write it up, and somebody's responsible to take care of that. There are a number of steps that are taken to make sure the place that these people work is safe. The last thing we want is for somebody to be injured. Why? Why? Because we don't want people hurt, number one, and because it always costs you money, number two. You don't want people getting injured. You stop and keep that from happening, because why in heaven's name would you want somebody hurt off the job and costing a lot of money for those injuries? I don't need to go into FELA law to discuss that, but it's what we do. Now, the single point we're making here is that I don't think that the proponents have made their case. The materials that we've looked at that Mr. Qualley just noted were 187 injuries, 20% of which were, in the last 4 years, slip and falls. The types we're talking about, he's suggesting take place on walkways. That's about 40 in 4 years. That's about 10 a year. This is 4,500 employees. This is 5,000 miles of track. Yep, people get hurt. It is not a good thing. We try to make sure people don't get hurt. But it happens on occasion. There's a comprehensive set of FRA rules and regulations that are followed. We do it internal. We do it external. And each railroad has its own set of inspectors because of those FRA rules that go down those tracks. Tracks, depending on the speed you can travel, have to be inspected, if not weekly, in some situations, semi-weekly. I'm belaboring the point, Mr. Chairman. It was a long answer to your question. But I simply want to say, I think before you create a new program, which is going to be charged back to the industry, that there be a compelling reason for doing that. And if we want to walk through the detail of this entire bill, certainly we'd be happy to do that, but that would be my answer to the question.
Mr. Sweeney.
Thank you, Senator, members of the committee. I'm Brian Sweeney, Legislative Counsel for BNSF Railway in St. Paul. Our position on this has been all along that this bill is very premature because no study has been done to determine whether or not there is, number one, a problem of the magnitude that's been described, number two, if this would even address the problem. We think that this should be held over, and the parties involved, including the union including the DOT and the railroad, sit down and work out a good faith analysis of what is the situation and what ought to be done about it. Reference was made to Illinois. The industry did exactly that with the UTU and the state. Mr. Qualley mentioned that there's litigation. That was litigation brought by a railroad that was not a party to that. That was Norfolk Southern, which does not operate in the state of Minnesota. But Union Pacific, which is represented by Mr. Appitz, BNSF represented by me, were parties to that, and we have abided by the agreement in Illinois. As was noted earlier, 219.5 does address the subject. One of the things I think to be done in the study is there a problem with this? If it's not being used, why isn't it being used? Is there a procedural system that needs to be put together? Frankly, in a quick review of these photos, some of these are things that would be covered by FRA regulations in that they involve conditions with the track structure itself and items on the track. So, there are some things that could be reported to the FRA if somebody makes that effort. And if somebody is not making the effort to report violations of the existing Minnesota statute, we ought to take a look at why, what's the problem, and how should it be handled. In terms of the number of injuries, over the last 3 years, BNSF has averaged about 6 slip, trip, and fall injuries per year in the locations that would be covered by this legislation. That's roughly a third of all of our slip, trip, and falls. In fact, we've had an average of 4 a year, people like me working in offices tripping on nice level floors with carpets. So we can't make the assumption that all 6 injuries occurring in these locations would in fact be addressed by this legislation. We're making this assumption that every one of them is attributable to this. I don't think that we can really say that. About half of those 6 injuries, by the way, are first aid, Band-Aid, ice pack, that type of injury. About half of them are more serious. There's no question about it. Even the ones that are minor in nature, that's 6 injuries too many. But we do work on addressing that situation. We spend a lot of money and a lot of effort in improving safety. The safety record over the years shows it. The bill has been amended. The latest amendment takes out about 520 miles of walkways my railroad would have to construct to deal with areas around detectors on the track. But the areas that it still addresses, we're looking at, for my railroad alone, about 700 miles of track. When you figure the yard tracks, the passing track sidings and whatnot, we still have a significant amount of track that would have these new requirements applied to them over time. Tracks are inspected routinely, as was noted, by both the company and by the Federal Railroad Administration. They are not only visually inspected, they are inspected with technology, what are called geometry cars, that traverse the system about 3 or 4 times a year, checking for level of the rail and the ballast, magnetic detection cars that come through every couple months and check for internal flaws within the track itself. The letter from the FRA, I think it needs to be emphasized that this was strong support for the concept of hiring an inspector. It did not make any mention of this growing problem that has been alleged over the last several years. It does not advocate imposing a tax. It does not advocate walkways. In fact, the bill contains a walkways provision for bridges that is counter to the FRA's policy. On the FRA's website, you'll find that when it comes to walkways on bridges, the FRA agrees with the railroad industry's policy of not having walkways on bridges except where it is essential for operational purposes because of, among other things, concern about the general public being on the bridges. So the FRA is not wholeheartedly endorsing this entire bill. Please, let's be clear about that. FRA has 9 inspectors at Fort Snelling who cover Minnesota and Wisconsin. The Wisconsin tax is applied to intrastate revenues. Wisconsin, however, is not part of the FRA State Rail Inspection Program. That is money used to hire people at Wisconsin, the Department Office of the Railroad Commissioner, which does functions that are done by the DOT in Minnesota. So again, I would say that this is a premature bill. We promise to work in a good faith effort with the other parties to come up with something practical and reasonable that should come back to this committee. Thank you.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sweeney, in looking at some of these photos, you're saying that you do have regular inspections and the like, and that some of these photos do show some federal violations. I mean, what is your practice as a company to, once you identify problems, how long does it take before you would actually address those situations?
Chair, Senator, I'm not sure. I don't know what railroad this is, where these situations are. But typically, we address them promptly. It may not be right this minute, but it's going to be promptly. As Mr. Appitz noted, there are several thousand miles of track in the state of Minnesota. As with the state highway system, I would be surprised if on any given day you can't find a number of problems in one location or another.
That's because we don't have any money to fix our stuff.
Senator, I knew that was a risky thing to mention for precisely that reason.
I never miss a chance.
I'm aware of that. Promptly. Any municipality that has to maintain its road system, there are potholes. I'm sure we're all surprised to hear that at this time of year. But, yes, we fix them promptly, but sometimes it may be a few days for some problems on some railroads in certain situations, depending on what is the condition of the track, what is its category for speed, how is it rated for speed under the Federal Railroad Administration's guidelines, how frequently is it inspected, how frequently is it used. So, yes, there could be some variation with that. Some of these items, the one that was mentioned with the worn switch, this isn't something that you just have on the shelf. So it has to be ordered, has to be manufactured, has to be delivered to the site, has to be installed. Yes, that's going to take a period of time to do something like that.
Mr. Chair, one other follow-up. Then also on the question about the federal inspectors, there's nine of them you've said, and in looking at some of these things, if there's no complaints being made, is that saying that some of these conditions are acceptable to the federal inspectors?
Chair, Senator, no, I'm not saying that they're acceptable. If an inspector saw it, they would contact the railroad, say, fix this or you're going to get a citation. They might write a citation on the spot. I think if it's not that the question is the UTU and its members filing complaints with the FRA? I don't know that they are on these. Some of these, if they're in the track structure itself, that's the FRA's territory. The FRA has a manual on track inspections and track standards and track maintenance. So if there's a violation involving the track, the broken ties and whatnot, if that's a violation, that can be brought to the FRA's attention. If our inspectors find it, if it's a situation that would cause that portion of the track to fail the FRA's track standards, then a repair would be made, or else a restriction would have to be put on the track. What will happen is the speed, the allowable speed, will vary depending on how many cross ties there are per mile, the condition of the cross ties within that period, within that stretch, and so on. So it may be that the track has defects in it, but it still meets the FRA standards for certain speed limits.
Thank you.
We're going to go Senator Sieben, Jungbauer, and then we're voting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, first I'd just like to say that I know that the railroads have been good employers over the years to many people. I also have some experience where I grew up with a girl whose father was killed working on the railroads, and they lived really near the railroad tracks in Newport. I guess, so my question here, or what I'm trying to get at, is why... I maybe understand some of your objections to other parts of the bill, but as you've stated, if your rail lines are safe, then why do you oppose having a state rail safety inspector? The federal government, the FRA, says clearly here that if the state would establish this this department, it would not be duplicative, and that Minnesota will realize a net gain in the number of safety inspections conducted in the state. And if one of your arguments is that you have thousands of miles of track to check and it's difficult to maintain, what's the problem with having more eyes on the rail line to help conduct those inspections so that the companies are able to better respond to safety concerns. So as is your intended purpose, there are less accidents or hazards or potential causes of injury or death. And I think I know the answer to that question, but still I'd just like to hear you state it.
Mr. Sweeney.
Chairman, Senator, a couple of reasons. You're probably guessing the cost, and yeah, that's going to be a part of the mix. But also there are 9 inspectors with the federal government at Fort Snelling. We sometimes get concerned about uniformity of inspection standards as applied by the federal and by the state inspectors. Sometimes there will be differences. But also, our basic objection is that there has never been anything done, no attempt made to demonstrate is there a need. There is instead an assumption that because we have people tripping and falling in some locations that are not really specified, that we should have, number one, a set of walkways, and then number two, just built to specific standards, and then number two, an inspector who will make sure that those walkways that we're assuming are needed to address injuries that we assume are even happening at those locations, we're going to have that inspector go out and take care of that. We think the whole thing is just premature. It's really cart before the horse to have a solution, an enforcement program, and a bureaucracy set up to enforce that before there's ever even been any attempt at determining whether or not there's a problem or what that problem is.
Mr. Sweeney, I think that Mr. Quayle, and I'm sure that I could even round up some members of the public or family members who have had people who are injured working in the railroad industry. And in my opinion, if the state can help ensure that there will be less injuries or death as a result of railway accidents, then it's sort of a no-brainer in my opinion. And I'm certainly, you know, would be happy to hear more about the cost specifically as it relates to Section 2 and how it will be paid for your individual railroads. But again, I just think that if the state has the opportunity to partner with the FRA to make our this industry safer, then there's no reason for us not to do that.
Mr. Sweeney, the cost argument to me doesn't wash, because I see those trains rolling out of Red Wing and I see all the corn rolling out the back end of it, and you probably drop enough to hire a federal inspector.
Senator, our primary objection is not cost, and I only led with that because I assumed that was what she was saying was going to be our objection. Our objection is, again, the cart before the horse. In terms of the dangers of working on the railroad, yes, there are dangers, and people do get injured. There's no question about it. As an industry, railroads are safer than average. Railroads have become exceedingly safer than they were 25, 30 years ago. As was noted, and I believe is in the packets that Ms. Pappas distributed, the rate at which injuries occur has plummeted on the rail industry over the last 25 years. It is safe. It is perhaps the safest mode of transportation, safer than barge, trucking, airlines. In terms of employee injuries, it is safer than grocery stores. It is safer than average American industry. So we have been taking this very seriously. We have been very diligent about safety. The results prove it. Are there still people being injured? Yes. To what extent? Frankly, what we've seen so far with this particular category of injuries that this legislation is aimed at, we're not seeing a whole lot. And if we're going to do something, I think it would make sense to find out where the problem is, what the problem is, and design a solution toward that, rather than making a broad assumption that there's 5,000 miles of track in the state of Minnesota, so we're going to have 5,000 miles of specified walkways, and by God, then nobody's going to trip and get hurt. And then have an inspector. So I think that, as I said, we're willing to work with the union and we're willing to work with the DOT to come up with a bona fide evaluation of the situation and a practical solution to it.
Senator Jungbauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sweeney, actually, I'm always on the side of safety and workers, and but I think you've done pretty good at making your case on part of it. If we have the general population that might be able to walk across a bridge or something that we'd specify here, we need to take a closer look at that. But I'm kind of interested in the argument of cost and things. And do you know if you get a slip, trip, and fall, and say somebody breaks their ankle, is out for 3 months, do you know what the cost of the railroad is of an injury like that?
Chair, Senator, the cost will vary because we're not under the state workers' comp program. We're under the Federal Employers Liability Act. It's a tort-based system that predates state workers' comp programs. There is probably some average for a broken ankle for settlement or litigation. I don't know what that is. But certainly, employee injuries cost us money. That's why we have taken a lot of effort and invested a lot of money over the years to reduce employee injuries, and we've been fairly successful in that effort. Have they been zeroed out? No. Like all industries, yes, we still have some injuries. Do we have as many as the average industry? No. We have fewer.
Mr. Chair, actually, I talked to a few workers in my district. And I won't go beyond that because I definitely don't want to be identified, but I talked to them about this legislation, and actually they weren't all that worried about doing something here, but some of them did kind of discuss some of their payouts for injuries. And I put the numbers to it, and I'm thinking the railroads come out way ahead by fixing this stuff rather than paying somebody if they get injured. So it really seemed like it was a pretty darn good deal to you guys to fix some of these things.
Yeah, Chairman Jungbauer, that's the way it is with all industry. You know that. Working in the business that you've been in for 100 years. I mean,
I've aged.
Railroad companies aren't doing too bad these days, gentlemen. And
Chairman,
and I understand what you're trying to say. You're saying that you're making progress. Mr. Qualley's trying to say that it's not fast enough because I'm looking back here and there's four or five people sitting in the back. And I bet that if I called any one of them up here and they're a railroad worker, I bet you that they could take you right out today and show you where some of those pictures were mm-hmm. taken. Now, you guys are doing pretty good. I mean, can't you put on a few more people to go out there and clean that stuff up?
Mr. Chair, yes. And, in fact, we do. And if complaints are brought to us, we address them fairly promptly. In terms of are we willing to spend the money? Absolutely, we're willing to spend money for safety. The question is, are we shooting shotguns or are we shooting rifles that are aimed at the real problem? Instead of the scatter approach of the entire system, we think that we have spent money to reduce injuries. We're willing to spend more money to reduce injuries, but let's make sure we're spending it where it's actually going to do something. We're willing to spend it in that manner.
Senator Skoy, and then we're going to
Mr. Chair, because the activity around here is done by motion, I'm going to make a motion. I listened to you read about the current state law that deals with 8 feet of right-of-way that's maintained clear and free that we currently have in law, and I listened to their arguments with regard to bridges and trestles, and I don't think we want the public on them. So I'm going to move that we delete Section 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, and I don't know, about 14. And basically what we'd be left with is a state rail safety inspector paid for by the railroad.
So let's see if we get this right. Senator Skoy, you're moving to delete.
I'm deleting basically everything other than the state rail safety inspector and the account that would assess the rail companies to pay for that inspector. I mean, the state law is already there for 8 feet free and clear along the tracks, and I honestly don't think that we want walkways on our bridges and trestles for the public to be on. And so I just look at this, and I think all the walkway law is covered, and we don't want them on bridges and trestles, and let's see where that goes, and maybe we'll end up with something else, but I thought maybe we should start.
Do Senator Scully, you deleted sections 3 through 14, or did you include 15?
Well,
four.
Maybe,
I'm sorry.
Maybe the council could help me a little bit. I don't know about the liability and the short title. I guess I probably wouldn't want to delete the effective date, but I don't know about those two provisions. And
Ms. Berzovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scoy, I think if the committee ends up deleting the sections about the reasonably safe walkways, probably section 14 could drop out as well, and section 15 could drop out as
so
well.
I'll move to delete those also.
Senator Scoy has moved to delete sections 3, 4, 5, sections 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15. That would leave us with the sections 1 and 2 of the bill and the effective date in section 16. Senator Dibble.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want people walking on bridges and trestles either. Actually, I was going to move to take section 4 out myself. So I'm fine with that part, Senator Scoy. Of course, I do think it's extremely important that we establish a state rail safety inspector. But, you know, this it might help to learn from Mr. Qualley, you know, where this safe walkway initiative comes from. It's, you know, it's not just being made up. It's, you know, it's important. It's important to establish. And this isn't for public access and the like. This is an important initiative that's being brought forward, you know, by the workers for a pretty good reason, to establish and make sure that these walkways are established so that workers can walk in clean, unobstructed areas alongside the tracks to do their job safely.
Mr. Qualley.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, I agree with Senator Dibble. I would speak against the motion, although I do want to point out that regarding the bridges, we did have a portion that we wanted to delete on that, so I apologize for the confusion on the part section 4 with bridges and trestles. However, that said, speaking to the walkways, if you look at the diagram, page number 9, you'll see a diagram. Even though this language is lengthy, I should say, it is very clear and concise and exacting as to where we're trying to improve walkways. And that is in areas parallel to the track where railroad workers regularly deboard equipment, throw switches, climb in between cars to make cuts on standing equipment, or service and spot industries. A piece of this as well is that there is an exemption that sets forth that these standards, which have been created in California and are in place in California, in Nevada, Oregon, and Tennessee, are because of improving the walking conditions for, you know, with a smaller aggregate in areas where we frequently work, thereby taking down the beating on our limbs, also reducing the stumbling hazard. And the key part of this bill is, respectfully, is that the carriers don't have to bring up that standard of the walkway provision of this bill until such a time they go in and fix one of those mainline turnouts or refix the rail or resurface the rail in that specific area. What we're really saying, Mr. Chairman and Senators, is that if you go in to pull out some ties underneath a rail and you are in this small, limited segment of track where we work frequently, daily, around the clock, leave that in the restored condition of smooth ballast, free of debris, and in such a shoulder clearance area that it's free of vegetation and it's free of steel that's come off the side of the cars. We think that this is a well-crafted bill, and it is also in the state of Illinois, and we believe it's in state's interest to help improve an industry. This sets a fine standard, And I hope I've answered your question.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Knutson, you want to come up here? I know you've wanted to testify. Senator Skoy.
Well, Mr. Chair, didn't I hear you read that our state law currently requires that to be free of debris and 8 feet from the center line?
8.5 feet.
8.5 feet. It sounds to me like it's already in law. I mean, if I'm missing something, I don't know what it is, but.
Mr. Knutson.
Yes, my name's Carl Knutson. I'm a retired track inspector. One of the people who had the FRA code memorized, and as I'm sitting here, it's suddenly coming back to me, although I haven't used it for some time. I've spent 20 years on Burlington Northern, and I was a union officer for part of that time. With reference to Mr. Scoey's amendment about bridges, I would like to respectfully, and I don't like disagreeing with Mr. Scoey for a variety of reasons, but in my experience as a track inspector, the presence or absence of a walkway had no effect on trespassing. The kids or the other people I would find, as I came around a corner, I'd find a bridge with people on it, whether it had track a walkway or not. I also lived next to the Milwaukee Road Short Line Bridge when the walkway on that was destroyed for a period of time. The trespassers simply walked around on the track. It makes no difference in that regard. Also, much of what Mr. Sweeney, and that's what I was got me going, was that much of what Mr. Sweeney's testimony was regarding FRA standards for track. For example, a 10-mile-an-hour track is expected once every 30 days. It's 2 weeks for 60-mile-an-hour track, or twice a week, I'm sorry. Those are the sorts of standards he was talking about. But there is no FRA standard for the kinds of walkway provisions that Mr. Qualley is talking about, at least not that I can recall. And I also ran yard cleaners and as a machine. The tie butts, Mr. Qualley is trying to address a problem that exists. That's all I want to say. Thank you.
All right. On the Skoy motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Senator Dibble moves that Senate File 1534 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Senator Dibble, this does have to go to Finance because of the torturous path that it got here. It came through Finance. It has to go back. So on the Dibble motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Aye. Motion does prevail. Committee's adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee members.
Thank you. I'm going to try to...